This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher. Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. So much of what inspires me and that I hope to highlight on this show comes from an ever-growing awareness of the incredible superpowers that humans have that emerge from our relationship with the natural world around us. Our senses, coupled with adaptability, the skill of collaboration, and the inventiveness of our creativity, have allowed humans to find a niche in almost every major biome on this planet. Whether it's forming a symbiotic relationship with the semi-wild reindeer of the Arctic Circle, or coastal people of the tropics evolving superior vision underwater, or our ability to communicate with wild species to understand imminent dangers or changes in the weather, or Polynesian sailors being able to navigate through open ocean by sensing the pattern in the waves. Everywhere that humans have made their home, they've developed unique ways of understanding, adapting to, and developing deep relationships with the forms of life and the environment around them. One of the most outstanding of our collective abilities is being able to manipulate the genes and the evolution of the species around us. We've done this with animal and plant domestication, breeding, and propagation, and more recently, with advanced technological tools. In past episodes, I've explored the topic of landrace gardening and low-tech plant breeding and adaptation to your place in your context. This is an idea that has captivated me in the last couple of years and is informing a major part of the development of my own farm. Now today, though, I want to take a step out of the details of landrace plant breeding to try and understand the broader potential of what partnering with the evolutionary trajectory of selected species in our sphere of influence could look like and the mind-bending possibilities that hide in that way of interacting with the environment around us. Here to explore this concept and give ideas based on his own experiences is Shane Simonson. Now, Shane is a longtime contributor to this podcast, so I'll keep his introduction short and recommend that you go back to some of the previous episodes to hear more of his backstory and his work. But briefly, Shane is an Australian experimental farmer developing zero-input agricultural systems and writing biological science fiction. In this conversation, we'll be taking a look at what Shane sees as the essential moment in our developmental journey as a species to make use of the temporary ease and the convenience of our global trade to do the hard work of accelerating our close partnerships with the plants and animals, bacteria, and fungi around us. We take a look at how people from the dawn of our evolution have been doing this, and how modern technology can even play a role in bringing these cooperative relationships to new heights. We also go into the steps and the actions that anyone can take to create climate-adapted food crops and maybe even tackle the next novel domestication project. Shane gives great examples of how he's running his own tests and experiments on his farm in Queensland, Australia, and shares his learnings and his failures and successes to help set expectations for what a landrace or breeding project entails. His new book, Taming the Apocalypse, is now available in digital and audio formats through subscription on his blog on Substack, and I'll have links to this and all of the other resources on the website at regenerativeskills.com. So with all of that out of the way, here's Shane Simonson. So Shane, welcome back. It's always great to talk to you, my friend. How are you doing?
I am doing great. So thanks for having me back.
Yeah, I'm really excited to get into the new book that you put out. I mowed through that material. It was fantastic. First of all, it's really short and accessible for people and does a wonderful job of summarizing some of the main concepts and the ethos that you have laid out in your blog for the last handful of years of the trials and the tests and the experiments that you're doing on your own farm in Australia, in plant breeding, in animal breeding, and this overall idea of zero input agriculture. So before we get into the details of the book, why don't you tell me about where your awareness of the fragility of industrial culture and then the desire to pioneer alternatives really sprouted from?
So the conscious awakening, I guess, was in the early 2000s. And it's one of these really weird coincidences in life. When I was doing my honors year, I started going down to the computer lab and I found one of the peak oil forums back in the very early days of the internet, where it was like all text, like this is how old I am. And I started talking to a person and I figured out they were in Queensland. And I kind of, you know, turned that idea over in my head, but then I got swept up in the rest of life. And it wasn't until a few years later that the GFC started to like build up momentum that I got back into that Peak Oil community, which was then on The Oil Drum, was the website. You know, they actually had like little flashing animations on the corners, and you know, it was that next generation of the internet. And then we had that giant spike in oil prices and the global economy nearly crashed. And I wasn't enjoying my academic career. I couldn't really see it going anywhere in this time in history. So I jumped ship and I moved my family to the middle of nowhere in a little rural village up in our mountains, which are hills anywhere else in the world. And I thought, what happened to that guy in Queensland that I'd chatted to all of those years ago? So I managed to find him online, and he was about a kilometer away, just up the road.
Very serendipitous.
Yeah, very, very strange. He's since moved to Tasmania. He couldn't handle the heat up here, whereas I love it. But yeah, that's kind of the genesis. Though I remember, and then again, this is just a little, you know, dead-ended insight. I remember being a child in the 80s sitting in my dad's car while he was filling up the petrol in like a dingy old, you know, outer suburban petrol station, and just watching the numbers roll over and just this kind of unformed thought about where the petrol came from and what life would be like if we couldn't drive anywhere, that if we had to walk everywhere, because we used to walk to school sometimes. It'd take quite a lot of time, and I really loved it. It was more fun than school. But yeah, I just suddenly became aware about how everything was thrown into motion by this magical stuff that just comes out of a tap.
And I think it's so important to look at kind of the spectrum of options when you come to those conclusions of how fragile and temporary the lifestyle that we all are accustomed to at this point really is. And I went through kind of my own awakening in this area. And, you know, I think, you know, they talk about like five stages of grief. I think there's five stages of understanding the fragility of your system. And one of the first ones is going into like the prepper movement, where you just buy ammunition and guns and stock up a whole bunch of terrible food that's going to go bad pretty soon. And eventually you get to somewhere like permaculture, or in your case, plant breeding and trialing, where it's not, okay, how do we hold on to the last scraps of this lifestyle as long as possible and defend it against all comers? It's more, how do we create alternatives? What are the options for adapting to the inevitable decline of these fragile resources that we enjoy? And, well, tell me about your thought form into that and how that has informed your life up to this point.
Well, one thing I did get from doing years of research in the lab is a sense of risk management when you're dealing with all of these unknowns, like how to distribute your limited resources and energy and time and attention to hedge your bets that you'll get something back, that you can make progress. And another really big important mindset that I try and keep in mind studying history, like how much it's changed. There's certain things that are relatively easy for us to do today that may not be possible in 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 years' time. And the one that I've identified right now is gathering biological resources. Mm. It's never been easier in the history of humanity to get a packet of seeds from, you know, halfway across the world and see if it will grow in your local area. And before industrialization, there was a patchwork of genetic diversity of crops all over the world. Every village would have their own particular strain of every crop that did well for them. That's mostly been lost with industrialization. It's sitting in little envelopes in like minus 70 degrees in freezers around the world, waiting for somebody to take an interest in it and put it back into motion to bring it back to life.
Yeah, and this goes into what I've explored now with the number of episodes and colleagues that you work with the Going to Seed Network and the concept of landrace gardening, but also taking that beyond and going into, you know, staple grain production, you know, animals as well. And you've been running a number of trials on your farm for a while, but the idea of, and I guess this is something that you described very succinctly, one of the best descriptions that I've ever found in how malleable the genetic information and the breeding overlap hybridization of not just the ones that we're familiar with, that we know that there are a lot of crosses available, but even the potential for horizontal gene transfer. I mean, I don't even know where to start with a question here because it is a really big topic and I'm not super well versed in it. It takes a better understanding of biology than I ever studied. Can you give me maybe a better description of how working with life is more of a choose your own adventure novel than it is this linear, you know, hoping for minor mutations and slow in inapproachable or unapproachable process?
So just to put things in perspective, so, and this is a little sampler from the book, something that I spelled out. So domesticating a new species is like the most complicated and ambitious thing that anyone can do. And I think, you know, a very small minority of people could maybe do one of those in a lifetime. Like I'm only trying to do one of those in my lifetime, what's left of it, though it's a fairly ambitious one. So for most people, you basically just want to assemble a functional agroecological system where all of the niches of the different kinds of products at different times of the year fit together so that you've got a relatively consistent and reliable diet. And you don't need to reinvent the wheel or the wheat, as it happens, if you happen to live in a wheat belt. So the first thing to look for is pre-industrial agricultural history. So look at what was grown in your area hundreds of years ago and see if there's a way that you can tap into those traditions. That is the first easiest way of approaching things. And that will usually cover a lot of your bases. I'm in a bit of a weird position in Australia because there is no pre-industrial agriculture from where I'm currently living. There was
certainly not the way Europeans think of it, yeah.
No. There was indigenous ways of using and managing the plants and the animals,
yeah.
Which has given us a lot of material and opportunities to work with, but some of those I'm running with. But we can't just rewind the clock a few hundred years because there was practically nothing before the machinery and the fertilizers came in, and we basically just reproduced, we forced that industrial model on the landscape. But yeah, if you happen to live in an area where there is a history of pre-industrial agriculture, look to that first. And it probably won't be the exact genetics. I mean, here's the thing. These landrace populations are dynamic. They're constantly changing. And they're diverse enough that they can change. So they're a bit of an insurance policy against climate change, for example. If your zones gradually shift for the next 1,000 years, which is quite possible, having a diverse population means you've got some room to play there. Even better, having a network of other populations in villages, you know, 10, 50, 100 kilometers away that are already in slightly different zones. The material could already be there. You don't have to, you know, come up with a new mutation from scratch. So when you go down that road, there's a small chance that you'll be able to take a heritage strain that's already pretty much well adapted. But more likely, you're going to have to trial a range of different heritage genetics of that crop and possibly allow it to mix up to make a more diverse population that you can start selecting for your current local conditions. So that's a relatively easy thing to do. Many crops are either wind pollinated or insect pollinated, so you just need to put them together and have them flower at the same time, and they'll do the rest. Then your job is just to select out the ones that you want to drive that evolution. Occasionally, you have to do hand pollination, which is a lot fiddlier. I'm gearing up to do that with quinoa at the moment, with the limited amount of genetics I've managed to scrape together. And I don't know if you've seen quinoa flowers before, but they're like a millimeter.
Microscopic, yeah.
So this is a good point to say this is also a time in history where access to information on plant breeding is easier than ever before.
Yeah.
So I managed to find a paper which talked about different methods to do controlled cross-pollination in quinoa. And it turns out, and I could have figured this out myself eventually with observation, but when a spike of flowers forms on quinoa, the terminal flowers mature first, and that's where the male flowers are. And then towards the base of the bud, you get female flowers. So you can prevent them from self-pollinating, which is what they usually do. That's what the easiest thing is for them, by snipping out the tip of the bud at just the right time and just being left with the female flowers. And then you just need to get pollen from another variety onto it within a couple of hours window, usually, that they're receptive. But here's the thing with this kind of controlled plant breeding. It doesn't take a huge amount of time, but it does, and it doesn't take a huge amount of effort, but it takes timing. You have to be at just the right place at the right time. And it takes attention. So you have to like keep track of like where you're supposed to be at what time. So it's a really good job, I think, for children. There would be a lot of breeding projects that I think children could do. And then you've got your whole lifetime ahead of you to perfect, you know, this crazy cross that you did when you were like 12 years old.
Yeah.
Or possibly older people, though vision and dexterity might start becoming an issue. Like, I think I'm just starting to lose my eyesight when it comes to doing the really, really fine work.
Well, me sitting here with glasses, I'm ahead of you. So I better get started soon before I lose the rest of my faculties.
So using those techniques will cover most of what you want to do. If you're trying to take a crop that's domesticated outside of the range that it's normally historically been grown, you may be able to do that by crossing it with wild relatives. So for every potato, there's like 50 species of wild potato relatives that could potentially contribute their genes. And that allows you to combine vigor with quality and then come to some kind of balance between those two. So I'm doing this with a range of crops as well. And it's a more ambitious thing, but I'm kind of forced to do it because I live in a zone where there isn't things that have already been proven to work.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work, then you're left with novel domestication. And here's the thing, like there's a lot of crops that were used and managed by indigenous people around the world because they're, you know, they're very nice to eat and they're productive. It's a gray area about whether they were domesticated or not. So a good example of this, we have a local legume tree called the black bean tree or Moreton Bay chestnut. It gets these huge pods with these like more than golf ball size, kind of this size. What would you call that? Like a large
plum?
Like
an avocado.
Yeah. So like a large plum size seed that's full of starch, but they're also full of toxic alkaloids and saponins. So if you bit into one of these things, you would have a really bad time. But the local Aborigines figured out a way to detoxify them. So they were a major staple crop. And they took the best clones from the tropical zone and shifted them all the way down into the subtropics. There was a recent genetic analysis on the populations, and they figured out that all of the ones in the southern half of the range were genetically bottlenecked to just these really large seeded forms. So the local indigenous people probably were responsible for spreading them over all of that range. So whether I can claim that I'm domesticating them or not, I don't know. I'm not doing a lot of breeding work with them because I don't have a lot of genetic diversity for that reason. But then there's other crops that were highly prized, but there's a less clear record about whether they were deliberately propagated or not. So, but like the bunya nut would be the example that I'm working on here.
Yeah. And so...
So yeah, that's a spectrum. Do the easy things, find what works. You don't have to make it difficult, but if you've got odd little times of year and certain kind of products that you just nothing seems to fit the bill, then you move down that chain of steps to see if you can find something that will work for you. And it's so fun and exciting, like just growing the same thing year after year, just having a few projects on the side where every year you don't know what's going to turn up. It just completely changes the dynamic in the garden.
Well, I think that's a perfect illustration of one of the things that you harp on in the book, which is the common saying that works in industrial civilization and reductionist science, which is if you do the same thing over and over and expect a different result, that's insanity. Whereas when you work with open pollinated and genetically diverse life, the exact opposite is the same. Can you explain that a little better?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So our industrial science is built around the principle of reproducibility, that you could come up with a series of steps and instruments and ingredients, and that any competent researcher should be able to reproduce that method. The reason why we prize this so much is because of the link between our research science and industrialization. If you want to make a factory that makes a dye or a plastic or a machine, it has to be able to do it over and over again, millions of times, perfectly reproducibly. Biology doesn't work like that. It is so complex and messy. We try to create these model organisms in laboratories where we like inbreed them and try and get rid of all of the variation. And we still end up discovering things like recently they discovered that laboratory mice, you get different results for certain experiments depending on whether there's male or female lab assistants looking after them because of the different, presumably the different pheromones coming off their bodies.
Hmm.
I suspect that individual males and females probably have different effects as well too then. So there's just too many moving parts.
Yeah.
And on the issue of hybridization and domestication, you only need a particular hybrid to happen once. Like there's often species that the first time you cross them, you get no seeds. Like there's incompatibility barriers between those species. Mm-hmm. But if you did it 100 times or 1,000 times or 1,000,000 times, eventually you would probably just have one random mutation that allows it to happen. Because it's a living organism, as long as it can produce its own offspring, then you've got a permanent change in the system. It's almost like a miracle in the way that it functions compared to, you know, reductionist science that just wants the same thing to happen over and over again.
Now, I would be a little bit remiss if we didn't cover the controversy of all of this, right? The potential ethical difficulties of playing with and mixing genes across species and subspecies. However, there's a big difference between how people associate that with, like, say, GMO crops and open breeding experiments like you're doing, to say nothing about the history of humans doing this. Can you illuminate this for me?
Yes. So firstly, it's worth pointing out that hybridization for speciation and horizontal gene transfer happens all over the place in nature with, like, no humans involved. It seems to be one of the dominant mechanisms for new species to form. I almost think of this as like a fractal, multi-leveled system. So in the same way that you could take two organisms and have them sexually reproduce to make offspring and kind of refresh the biological system, like by bottlenecking it through just a couple of cells, I think a similar thing happens when you have two species, which are whole populations of organisms, cross over and combine once in a blue moon. And through that union, through that narrow union, either just backcross that genetics to either population to kind of inject a bit of diversity into them, or to create a whole new hybrid population that never existed before. And it's really interesting, the mathematical models that we use to analyze the evolutionary trees of different species, we assume that it's a simple branching tree. Remember Darwin drew that little sketch in his book about, like, species splitting? Mm-hmm. If you take that mathematical model and you force the data to obey it, you end up with what they call a consensus tree. Mm-hmm. But if you actually look at the weeds at individual genes, like, they use many different genes to build these trees, different genes create different trees when you use them on their own, which is suggesting that they've jumped between different populations by hybridization in the past. Yeah. So there's a new emerging mindset in evolutionary genetics where they actually use models that allow for branching, that allow for crossing over and hybridizing in these big tangled networks in the past. And they work just as well. So, I mean, you've got so much data in the modern genetic revolution now. You can basically make it do whatever you want.
Yeah, it's just so wild to think about. And one of the things that occurred to me in this section of the book where you're talking about, you know, all the possibilities and, like, okay, does this sit well with me? Is it kind of weird to try and cross these maybe dissimilar species or, you know, play with the genetical trajectory of some of these plants or animals? At the same time, if you think about how we're currently doing it, we're inbreeding everything. And I don't think that's better. I don't think mm-hmm. increasing bottlenecks of genetics and kind of incestuous relationships that cut off the genetic possibility is a better option. And so hybridization seems to be almost the more ethical way to work mm-hmm. with our biological symbionts in this space.
I would also point out, if you look at the history of agriculture, virtually every crop and animal that we've domesticated has hybrid origins. So the oldest, most traditional organic agriculture that you can imagine is all built on what was probably accidental hybrids that humans noticed and started to care for and then selected from that original hybrid diversity, things that worked for them to bring a symbiosis. I mean, I often think about wheat is a really good example. It's a hybrid of three different grass species, like two of them hybridized, and then that hybrid population hybridized with a third species from different genera of grasses, like not even in the same genus. So, I mean, species, genus, what does it even mean? It's just a convenient label of relatively cohesive populations in this brief period in time. But when you look in the long term, all life is connected on a genetic level, particularly when you consider viruses and bacteria moving little snippets of DNA between everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really like how you explained that in the book, because I had never thought about it that way, that the organizational structure that we've put to label and segment
parts of populations and the way that they branch and evolve from one another is totally a construct. And there are a lot of shortcomings to limiting it this way or seeing them as incompatible with one another. And you break it down to there's really only four, which are the building blocks of the DNA, which is
ATCG. That's the four species.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and everything else is just symbiosis of those four things on steroids.
Yeah, yeah. And the very early mutations in protists that were the real revolution that then turned into all of the multicellular life that, I mean, so I'm geeking out about this because this is new to me. I realize that you've been steeped in this information as an academic for a long time, but because I don't have a background in biology, a lot of this is occurring to me, you know, in real time. And it's super exciting and given me a whole renewed interest in the area. Now, I'm not an academic, and there has to be some way to do something with this information. So let's start to go into the call to action in this book and what is really being advocated for in tampering and playing around with all of these possibilities.
Well, it's another example of being aware of our time in history and the things that we can do now that haven't been possible in the past or future. So if you were a pre-industrial peasant, you would have a suite of crops and livestock that you had traditions that had been proven over time to produce just enough food to kind of like get you by. And there wasn't very much room for exploration and taking risks. Like, I'm going to go off and like hand pollinate these inedible toxic things that, you know, nobody likes. No, get back to plant another acre of wheat. Otherwise, we're going to starve.
Yeah.
So the system and biological systems do this as well. They push themselves during times of relative stability to the edge of possibility, and they refine things just by making little tiny adjustments, low risk adjustments, and they end up getting boxed in by that perfection. And you end up with a situation called punctuated equilibrium, that you end up with long stretches of evolutionary history where not much seems to change. Like the ecosystem fills in all the niches, everyone knows what they have to do, and there's really no payoff for taking risks. And then a huge volcano goes off or an asteroid hits the planet and everything gets wiped out. And in the aftermath of that, there's a brief window where experiments are possible, because as things start to recover, there's now more capacity. Like, life isn't optimized to fill in every little tiny gap. There's all of these open niches. There's all of these changes.
Things are being
species have been
at the
moved
wall
to different locations. Yeah, there's all these hybridizations happening that didn't happen before because individuals that managed to survive have wandered off in random directions.
Mm.
And my idea is that this time in history, humans have a potential to do those kind of wild, crazy experiments, because we're not going to starve if we don't instantly produce as much food as possible. So you can afford to take a few years of playing around, of hitting dead ends, until you finally stumble onto something that's actually valuable and works. And 50 years from now, maybe people won't have that luxury. Maybe they'll just be growing the same old potatoes and being too afraid to, you know, hybridize them with wild potatoes, or unable to source those wild potato relatives because they're on the other side of the planet and we don't have an internet and a postal system and a banking system that makes it easy anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It would be really a shame to miss this window of possibility for being distracted for other things that come from the window of possibility. So
it also means you don't have to feel so down about the idea of the Industrial Revolution and all of the like chaos and transformation and craziness that it's caused. It's a kind of asteroid that hit the planet, but if we use it to its greatest potential, it can transform the kinds of societies and ecosystems that can happen on the far side. And the far side it's a big far side. We've got like 30 odd million years left on planet Earth for complex life. Like, what are we going to do with it? What other species could we bring into the fold? Like, it doesn't just have to be about us. Like, I'm not sure I want us to have the responsibility of managing everything forever.
Yeah.
It seems kind of like a burden. Let's train other species to help us to do it. I mean, we were kind of doing that. Like, you look at pre-industrial agriculture and there were so many animals that we partnered with. But even that is only a tiny pinch of the possibilities of species that we could domesticate.
Yeah. So you do a really good job about giving a preview of some of the more standout possibilities in quite a range of genera and species, both plant, animal, and bacteria. So I'm not going to make you go through the list or anything, but maybe you could.
It's a long list.
It's a long list, and it's really cool because I had never considered some of these possibilities, nor knew that there are previous examples of maybe not domestication, but taming of certain animals, or perhaps previous domestication of some plants that were then abandoned when it wasn't suitable and could be taken up again. There's so much opportunity here. What are some of the ones that you would like people to maybe understand to get a taste of what's in the volume?
I will throw out the one that I'm just going to focus on, one that I think is the most ambitious, but with the highest potential return on investment in the long run. So the wild ancestors of modern cattle are extinct. Those populations are gone. If they hadn't have been domesticated, that window would have been gone.
Yeah.
So previously, our global ecosystems, our terrestrial ecosystems, were managed by megafauna. All of these really, really large animals that had the ability to push over trees. And elephants are the only ones left, really, that still serve this role in Africa, and they maintain the functioning of the savannas. So they don't actually eat acacias all that much, but when they see one that they don't like the look of, they'll spend like an hour shoving it until it comes over. And we presume that they are smart enough that they actually understand what they're doing. They're farming that forest to allow more grass to grow, which is their preferred food, and the preferred food of a lot of the other animals in those ecosystems. And elephants are going through an extinction crisis. We only have two or three species left. It depends on how you divide them up. The Asian species can be divided into subpopulations. But my proposal is that we have a window of opportunity to fully domesticate elephants in this time in history. And they've previously been extremely useful in agriculture and in warfare, in like Carthage. That was one of their major troops that they sent out to fight Rome. They've been tamed, but they haven't been domesticated. So they're partway there. The really exciting thing to note is that there is a recorded hybrid between African and Asian elephants. And I think this is where the possibility probably lies, to make a gargantuan effort to bring those two species together and see if we can get them through the reproductive difficulties that they have in domestication at the moment. So there's a lot of Asian elephants that are tamed from the wild and then used for agriculture mostly, but getting them to breed in captivity has proven to be extremely difficult. We haven't quite figured that out yet. And I suspect that a hybrid between those two remaining populations, which is possible, it's happened in a zoo before when they put a male African elephant and a female Asian elephant in the same enclosure. They assumed they were not cross-fertile, and then a baby popped out. I think it was either a bit sickly, or they destroyed it because they thought they needed to maintain the purity of the two species.
Yeah, that's interesting, especially because the way that you talk about it in the book of the potential here is a replacement or an alternative to the machinery that we currently rely on with cheap fossil fuels like bulldozers and diggers and other things that they're uniquely capable of taking over some of that role from.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. You look at the pre-industrial history, if you wanted to use cattle or horses to do those kind of jobs, you needed a huge amount of complicated equipment, tack, like yokes and bridles, and getting the machinery to coordinate with the animal's power was extremely difficult. And cows are lovely. They're very strong, but they're not very intelligent. Horses are more intelligent, but they're also a little bit flighty depending on the breed. But elephants have an extremely powerful and dexterous trunk on the front of them. They're incredibly intelligent. I would really love to imagine a system where we don't need to walk around with a whip telling the elephant what to do 24 hours a day, that the possibility for a partnership where humans and elephants in a forest ecosystem can both be productive and cooperative elements that make that system as, as wonderful as possible for both parties.
Well, I think that's the key thing here that I also really latched on to is when we think of domesticated animals right now, a lot of this is, you know, feedlots, closed confinement, and that's a horrible vision of domestication. It's not what you're advocating for here. What you just said right now is a partnership, a symbiotic relationship in which both species win and the benefits for the collective is increased through relationship. That's a different idea of domestication than I think many people have in their heads.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like plant domestication. It's not black and white. There's a spectrum of intensity of relationships that can be established. Reindeer, I think, are a really good living example of a semi-domesticated species. They're the only large livestock that really works in those regions. And the people just follow them around, do some protection from predators. I think they do some management of the livestock, so they kill some of them. But that substitutes as the role of the wolves that would previously, you know, manage the size of the population and keep the whole ecosystem healthy.
Yeah, it's man, there's so much that we could dig into here. And for anybody who wants to peek into it, like I caught on to the idea of semi-domesticated or fully domesticated alligators or crocodiles and estuary ecosystems with mangroves, and how also there could be human populations that carry on the attributes in order to thrive in these areas that they haven't traditionally lived, right? You're talking about some of the attributes that occur currently in subpopulations of humans in certain areas, like the ability to see more clearly underwater from people who've lived and derived their living from the coast. And, you know, since we've all been mixing more so than ever before through the ability to travel easily and cheaply, that there are also really unique opportunities for, I really struggle to use words like optimizing, and, you know, because it does bring back these ideas of eugenics and human breeding projects that were horribly misguided. But at the same time, much like you said about the other species, these crosses have been happening organically anyway, that perhaps with a little bit more direction, not with the horrible ideas of race or purity or hierarchy, but rather with adaptability to unique ecosystems and being able to thrive with the resources that are available in those areas. Maybe it's sensory abilities. Maybe it's the ability to digest and make use of unique plants in those areas or form symbiotic relationships with microbes that occur in those. Talk to me about how you see it.
So to address the specter of eugenics, so the way most people conceptualize eugenics, I think, is a really good example of the industrial reductionist centralized controlling model of approaching a potential technology.
Yeah.
And it necessarily leads to atrocities because it is trying to force a particular result in a predictable way in a limited period of time.
Yeah, sure.
That's where the horrors come, when there's a disconnection between the people making the decisions and the subjects who just have to be forced along with it. That doesn't have to be, that isn't inbuilt into the idea of using biology in creative ways to discover new possibilities. So, for example, everybody engages in a form of eugenics, well, everyone who becomes a parent, when they select the best possible partner that they can find in their world to do that, you know, very, very vital process with. We all want the strongest, most capable children that we can possibly produce. And yeah, we look for someone who's compatible. Humans naturally do a lot of assortive mating. So people who are really brainy usually get partnered up with people who are really, really brainy, and they tend to produce more brainy children, and vice versa for any other trait that you can imagine. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting to play around with the ideas, and I'm a science fiction writer, so this is something that I like playing around with. But the idea of a, you know, government or board billionaire sponsored program to audition people, it's like, do you have this particular unusual trait? Wim Hof with his cold tolerance would be a really good example of this. Could you create a village of Wim Hofs? Could you put out a call around the world and say, come and be on this reality TV program, and you can live in this sponsored village for the rest of your life with all of these other people who just are completely immune to like diving into freezing cold water?
Yeah.
And see if you want to create a new village. Anyone is free to come and go whenever they want. We're not putting you in cages. We're not, you know, forcibly impregnating you. it's just putting the right kind of people in the right kind of place and giving them a little bit of support to kind of get that started.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also kind of the starting block of the premise of your science fiction series, right?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Maybe tie that in real quick and then we'll come back to this book because I love these concepts.
So the world that I've imagined in my science fiction, our vitreous womb, is a distant future, 30,000 years in the future, which is a blink of an eye, evolutionarily speaking, but a lot can happen in that time. Like, you can repeat the domestication of wheat in 10 years. They've done it in the lab. So just getting the right things together at the right time, you can do all sorts of crazy things. So in this future world that I've imagined, it's a kind of distributed collectivist, I guess you'd say eugenicist system, where there's all these little different pockets of humanity that live in relative isolation that each have a specialist role that then integrate with all of the other pockets around them to create a dynamic, integrated superorganism that spans an entire continent and is moving towards spanning the entire world.
I don't even know where to go from that because the concept is so novel to me. And so what we're going with the book currently is here's how to get started along a path that creates further symbiosis with these things that we have, you know, lived adjacent to, perhaps evolved parallel to, but there are opportunities to merge our paths in other ways. So
yeah,
you gave the example of elephants. Maybe we should go a little bit more into some of the plant possibilities, and then we can go into how you're testing this on your own farm.
Okay. Let me think of the most prominent plant that stands out as something interesting. Oh, okay. So here's one. So if we want to get sugar from plants, there's a limited number of ways we do it. So a relatively old way is using bees to gather nectar, concentrate it. So that's a rare example of a domesticated insect. And there is so much more potential for domesticating insects. We've only done a couple of them. And there's obstacles to overcome. But anyway, read the book I'm talking about. But that's not the only way to get sugar out of plants. Another way is to grow something like sugarcane that builds up a lot of sugar in its tissues. And then you have to cut it and crush it and boil it. And there's all of these intensive processes. It's good at producing sugar, but it's not good at delivering it to humans in a form that's useful to us. There's all these other steps we have to do. So ants are a really great example of a species that's done society, it's done war, it's done slavery, and it's done domestication. Like millions of years before, you know, these weird hairless monkeys started imitating them. Like, stop copying us, fire monkeys. They didn't do fire. We'll at least have that up on them. So when ants form symbiotic relationship with plants, the plants often produce these extra floral nectaries, these little bumps and lumps that secrete nectar that encourage the ants to hang around. And as a result, the plants don't have to invest energy in like toxins and thorns, because when caterpillars and giraffes turn up, the ants go running out and like make their life miserable. So it got me thinking, it's like, could we evolve a plant to serve the same role for us? To provide nectar for us in a way that doesn't need all of the crushing and the cutting, and you know, you don't have to turn the plant inside out to get the sugar out. And there's many options for this, but the one that really stands out for me are the grevilleas. So this is a genus of really beautiful flowering plants related to macadamia from Australia, and they hybridize like crazy. There's like 500 species of them all over the place, and they're mostly bird pollinated. They've got these large, chunky, colorful flowers that are robust enough for birds to land on, and they produce so much nectar that when you walk underneath these, it'll rain down on you. You'll get covered in like sticky honeydew from like bumping the branches when they're fully laden. So I could see that as a species that could be developed into a nectar crop, that the shape of the flowers isn't optimized for birds. It's optimized to hold a portion of nectar that only humans can open up and get access to.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're free to do whatever we want with that. And point, the indigenous people used to collect the nectar from them, but they'd just shake the flowers out into like a bowl and then drink it. But I think we can do one better.
Yeah. Was that one in the book? I didn't even hear about that one.
It might be. That's a big chunky section. I hope it wasn't too overwhelming.
No, not at all. I read it cover to cover. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's what I was saying. Like, I do remember the part about nectar production, but I didn't remember the optimization for the flowers in it. That's the thing is, I can imagine that you have done so much work in just distilling and keeping it simple for people like me to be able to understand it so well. I can only imagine how many other bits and pieces that had to be trimmed from this in order to make it more digestible. All the more reason to keep the conversation going.
Since I finished the draft, I've stumbled onto a range of other unusual potential staple crops in families that I didn't think had anything in them before. And I'm like, do I go back and I put them in? I'm like, no, there's already more than enough. Like, I pointed out in the book, this is the tip of the iceberg. Like, if you look around your local area, you will probably find like 10 other species that I didn't even think to put in here.
Well, and that's kind of the point that you also make in the volume, is that it's more important to understand the patterns and the principles that you're trying to get at, rather than looking at this as a list of instructions or a list of recipes that one needs to follow. You talk about it in, you know, Fukuoka's Folly or Failure. And
yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that Fukuoka got to the end of his life after all of the work that he did. And he admitted he was a complete failure. Like, he didn't think he had actually achieved anything that he'd set out to do, because he took a lot of time to do all of the attention and the energy and being at the right place at the right time, trying different things, hitting dead ends. He did that for years before his system started to work. And like, his family and his neighbors thought he was a complete lunatic for ages. It's like, just buy a bag of fertilizer, make, you know, a pittance like we do, and get on with it. Yeah. And he refused. He kept doing these crazy experiments until it worked on his particular patch of land with his particular genetics of crops that he'd developed. So there's no shortcutting that process. And a really good example of this is one of the many people who came to work with Fukuoka on his farm and observe his system tried to imitate what he did in another part of Japan, like not even a particularly different part of Japan. And it failed. Like, he couldn't get it to work. And he had seen the exact system working on Fukuoka's farm. He probably took some of those genetics with him, but he was trying to start getting the system to work too far into the process. He needed to back it up source wider genetics, try different techniques, maybe even completely different crops.
Yeah. Yes. There's no way of shortcutting that process, like you said. And if someone is giving you instructions about how theirs happened, doesn't necessarily transfer to either the plants or the animals that you're working with, the soil conditions, the climate, the timing. You have to create these relationships and these deep observations if this is what you're trying to achieve.
And of all the crops I've trialed here, I would say 90% of them have probably been a dead end. So it takes a certain kind of personality to do that.
Yeah.
And I think I point out in the book too, this isn't a path. Well, the most extreme forms of it isn't a path for everyone, but you only need like one or two people in every bioregion doing this to create like a little Noah's Ark, a little nest egg of species and genetics that if and when people need them, they're on offer. And biological resources are the only resources that can multiply and multiply and multiply every year, that can undergo that exponential growth where before you know it, everyone has, you know, wheat that they can grow that actually likes that particular valley that you're living in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only real investment worth undertaking, in my opinion, as well. Like, everything else is entropic, and this is the only thing that has the possibility for self-organization, for reproduction, for discerning use of scarce resources without inputs. You know, there's nothing that compares to the biological potential in these things.
The only missing ingredient is human culture, which I think is equally self-renewing and adaptable, and it can propagate in the same way, probably even faster than biological resources. Though that can sometimes be dangerous, because you get, you know, mass panics and hysteria, and that's the flip side, you know, witch burnings and all those kind of things can also spread from mind to mind like a wildfire.
Right. Yeah, we're just as susceptible, permeable, and malleable as the things that we're talking about here in other ways. Now, everything that we're talking about so far, plants and animals specifically, require a land base. And there's plenty of people listening right now who do not have access to that, who do not particularly aspire to manage a big piece of land, but might still be interested in one of the unique possibilities in taming microbes. Can you talk about the potential there?
So there is a thriving movement of people doing home-scale microbiological research around the world. I mean, you can do plant tissue culture as well. It can be a little bit more expensive to set it up. But with these novel breeding techniques, like I said, often the limiting resource is time and attention, or timing and attention. And even if you've only got a small greenhouse or, you know, a cupboard for doing microbiological culture, you can still do really crucial work on that small scale. So, for example, doing controlled crosses between different species where you have to do really, really fiddly, tiny little stuff. Somebody who's managing like 100 acres and has like animals and trees and stuff running around, they usually won't have time, or they won't have time available at the exact moment you need to do that. Whereas someone who's doing, you know, like living in the suburbs or an apartment and doesn't have like all of that other overhead might potentially be in a better position to do that kind of work. Particularly, I can see a lot of potential for a lot of semi-domesticated crops have defense chemicals in them that make them difficult to process. So oaks with their tannins are a really great example of this. What I would really love to see somebody develop is a form of fermentation that breaks down tannins, so you don't have to do all of that leaching work, and oak could become a major staple crop without having to transform the oaks. You could keep those defense chemicals, which are really useful. Like, it makes it easier. You don't have to protect the crop because, you know, squirrels can only eat so many acorns before it pickles their guts. But human beings could potentially come up with something like a tempeh or a kombucha that, when you put it in contact with maybe cooked acorns, it does the final step and converts it into something that is edible. And this already happens with soybeans. Like, if you are eating soybeans that have just been soaked and boiled, you are very quickly going to run into problems with protein digestion, with hormone regulation. Thyroid systems are going to go out. And Asian cultures have always known that you don't eat raw soybeans. You ferment them in all these different ways. And even then, you only eat them in limited quantities. So, yeah, and for every domesticated crop, there are wild relatives that still have these toxins that make them complicated to process. Rather than transforming the crops to breed out all of those toxins, all of the people who are currently trapped in suburbia, if they're interested in this kind of thing, could become microbiologists, pair up with somebody living out on the fringes who they might even have this species growing wild, like the black bean tree that I talked about. Yeah. I could harvest, you know, sacks of this stuff. I haven't gotten around to figuring out how to do the traditional processing technique because it's long and complicated and you just get starch out at the end. But if I could ferment it, that would work so much better.
And it can go in multiple directions too. I know that there is a nursery not far from me that breeds sweet chestnuts, which are much lower in tannin. So you don't even necessarily have to start with the most tannin-rich ones, which are all over my area. It's mostly Quercus ilex and suber. And, you know, we get the cork from those, and the acorns from the encinas are traditionally for pigs. But if you could transfer that directly to our own diets, you know, very, very cool.
And oaks have a huge amount of potential. So I only discovered this recently. The center of diversity for oaks is in Mexico.
Yeah.
They're not actually a temperate genus. If you look at most of the fossil record, they only relatively recently, a few of them hybridized and followed the retreating ice sheets when they figured out how to become frost tolerant. So if you look in Mexico, there are crazy diversity of oaks, including some that have acorns the size of apples. Like, I would love, and it's in a subtropical area, but in isolated Australia, it's already difficult to get access to that material, but it could potentially be such an amazing crop. But the potential for breeding those diverse warm climate oaks into the cold climate ones to start improving qualities in all sorts of different directions. I mean, this was already starting to happen in the eastern United States with the indigenous people. They were managing the oaks that they were relying on to nudge them towards being more productive and useful. Mm. And of course, all of that collapsed at a heap when the Europeans turned up, and, you know, we all know that story. Yeah. But the plants are still there. Like, they haven't, that amount of genetic change doesn't go away in just a few centuries. They're, they're out there waiting for us. They're like, where are the humans? They're out here looking after us before, and they're off doing other things at the moment. It'd be nice to have them back.
Yeah. Man, and the nice thing is there are already very active and welcoming communities around things like fermentation and plant breeding. It's like, you don't have to start from scratch. There's so many people who are passionate about this and probably likely to, you know, adopt you in and hold your hand through the beginning. And, you know, I'm part of in the process of finding these people in my own area as I start the tree nursery and start my own initial projects on plant breeding. And, you know, there's a lot of seed savers around here. There are people who have done incredible work at gathering and propagating heirloom varieties of cultivars that have gone out of fashion recently, but are from and adapted to this area. And this is really what I'm trying to tap into right now. Why don't you tell me about the instructions and the advice of getting people started that you've got in this book and how that's worked out for you?
I think I'm blanking on that exact section now that you mentioned it.
I've got it open here. We can go through it if you want.
Yeah, I think I might have gone through it before. Was that what I was talking about? Start with traditional crops and then gradually move through to considering novel domestications, or is that another section?
I mean, chapter 17, general strategies, there's a lot in here about...
Yeah, I think that's where I talked about, like, be prepared to reinvent maybe one wheel in your lifetime with a novel domestication. But yeah, it's very much that process.
Your area and starting to figure out what grows vigorously first.
Yes. Yeah. I am a big believer in sincerity. And a sincere plant for me is one that wants to grow, whether I want it to grow or not. So if I want it to grow, then that's a crop. That's amazing. I love it. Thank you for being so generous and helping me. If I don't want it to grow, then that's a weed. That's something that I have to put some effort into managing it in order to balance out the desirable and the undesirable species. But all of the productivity in any ecosystem is coming, like the vast majority of it is coming from those weedy, sincere species. There might be native ones as well too in your region that are kind of neutral, that you're happy to have them around, but if they turn up in your veggie garden, you might chase them out. So I guess there's a spectrum there too.
Yeah, fat hen in my case.
Yes, yeah. So I think we have to be aware that our precious, fragile, you know, protected crop species that we think are the source of our sustenance, they're really just the tip of an ecological iceberg, because it's all of the weeds and native species that are, you know, preventing the landscape from washing away, that are maintaining the water cycle and probably producing biomass that's ending up in our vegetable garden in a concentrated form. So I encourage people to move further down the spectrum of vigor and sincerity to look for species that can do something useful for you. Maybe not as useful as like a hybrid, you know, glasshouse tomato that's going to like produce huge amounts of crop if you get everything perfect, but still give you something and ask something of your return, and that can be scaled up across, you know, these open, increasingly abandoned landscapes outside the urban and suburban centers in the world that are lacking human attention and care and interaction. There's a big wide world out there outside the suburbs, but I do feel for the people who are stuck in the suburbs for now. I mean, that was me for a decent chunk of my life. That's how I managed to set myself up on the farm now, and not everyone gets that opportunity given the state of the economy and the real estate market around the world.
Yeah, for sure. Now let's talk about how you have made this work in your own experiments and on your own land, some of the main trials and the progress that you have found given the unique limitations and challenges of where you live.
Yeah, so a bit of context, just in case people haven't heard me go on about this before.
This is episode four on this podcast. I can refer them to previous episodes.
Yeah, well, I'll give them an overview. So Australia didn't develop any recognizable form of agriculture, probably for a reason. So on one side, we've got the Pacific Ocean, which goes through El Nino and La Nina cycles. And more recently, we figured out the Indian Ocean does the same thing. It's got this kind of flip-flop behavior. And depending on which combination of flipping and flopping on both sides you have, you either end up with an extremely wet year or an extremely dry year. And the El Nino cycle is about 11 years long, that you go from really, really wet to really, really dry and back again. So we're in the subtropics on the eastern coast. And in the time I've been on the farm, we have had a -5 degree frost, but most years you don't get any frost in winter. So really tropical species, you'll kind of get them going, and then you'll get those rare frosts that knock them out. Last year, we had 400 millimeters of rain through the whole year. So that was like 9 months without any useful rain. The year before that, we had 3 meters of rain. There was like 9 months where it didn't stop raining. The highlight of that was 1 week where we got a meter of rain in like 7 days.
Whoa.
So, and that was within like the space of a few years. It went back and forth between those extremes. So if you look at most of the regions in the world that have civilization, they have staple crops, grains that you grow during the wet time of the year, and then you harvest and store during the dry time of the year. So Egypt is the perfect example of that because the Nile floods almost like clockwork until they were smart enough to dam it.
Yes.
Who thought that was a great idea? But I mean, dams fall apart, so it'll get blown up. So, you know, they're fighting about all the dams on the Nile at the moment. So they probably won't be around for like as long as the pyramids, at least.
Yeah.
So when you're in a climate that is unpredictable, it's very difficult to justify investing all of the time in planting a grain crop because the rain may not turn up after you do all of the preparation and you can't even start the crop. Or when you go to harvest it, it's so wet that you can't actually dry it and preserve it. So I've been experimenting with flower corn, like the white maize that's often grown in the lowlands of Central America. And I've been very lucky to get genetics that works with my pest populations, seems to tolerate my fairly crappy soil. But I'm starting to do trials where I analyze how much energy I put into it in terms of days of work and how many days worth of food calories do I get out of the end. And it looks like when everything goes right, I can get around about 5 to 1 energetic profit, which is like the bare minimum if you want like a really basic medieval style rural village. Because you need to have energy left over to like build houses and make tools. And there's all these other things you have to
do. Dedicate if you're all only your time just to crop production.
Yeah. If it's 1 to 1, and it's also a buffer, like you have to be able to build up some stored crops for the inevitable years when you get crop failures to kind of tide you over.
Sure. And many of the world's climates in the long non-growing season.
Yes. Yep. So looking at the reality of my crops, of my climate, maize can never be a main staple crop here. It's not reliable enough. About 1 in 3 years, it's too dry. And about 1 in 5 years, we get a flood and it's too wet. Though there might be ways I can grow it in different parts of the farm that don't get flooded quite so badly. But even then, harvesting and drying the crop at any scale is going to be really challenging. Like you need to do, I don't know, 150 kilos per person if you want that to be the staple crop. I don't know if you've... Anyway, if you've only got a small suburban house, like hanging up and drying that amount of maize per person, it's a big undertaking if the weather's against you. Like it's a very tricky thing to scale.
Yeah.
So that's forced me to look at other kinds of staple crops. And the one that's come through that can handle my thin clay soils and my variable rainfall is the canna. It's called arrowroot or achira, or I think it's got a bunch of other names. So it was a really old staple crop from lowland Peru, which is on the same latitude as us, though they've got a slightly more stable climate than us. And it's currently grown in the highlands of Southeast Asia, where the soils are too thin to grow rice paddies. Like you need a reasonable terrain to put a rice paddy on it. And some places are just too mountainous. So in Southeast Asia, they grind up the tubers and they extract the starch out of them. And when you do that, even in wet weather, it's quite easy to dry that starch. And once you've dried the starch, it's twice as energy dense as grain, and it's way easier to store. So when you store whole grain, it's got oils that go rancid if you store it for too long. It's got proteins that attract beetles and mold if it's not perfectly dry. You can get away with so many years, but eventually it's going to be not that great to eat. Like it's going to be, you know, barely edible. Whereas if you can dry and protect your starch reserves, it could potentially see a civilization or a society go through much bigger fluctuations in the climate.
Yeah.
So, and it loves our conditions. It grows opportunistically. Basically, anytime the rain turns up, these perennial stands will put on biomass and produce tubers.
Yeah.
It has a relatively long harvest and processing season. With grain, you've often got like a couple of days that you have to get it in. Otherwise, you'll lose half of the crop. That's what happened to me this year. I lost a lot to pests because I didn't turn up at the right time. But with canna, you've probably got like a month where you'd have fairly optimum starch levels. And it's a bit more involved to do the processing, but then once it's processed, the storage is much easier. So there's always trade-offs and swings and roundabouts, but
sure.
It's one of the species I think has a lot of potential here.
You might be happy to know that I just put those into starting pots, the kind of grec that you sent me back in the pandemic.
It'll be very interesting to see how they go. So it's normally thought of as a subtropical or tropical species.
Yeah.
I've sent some of my hybrid seeds to people in Canada and like the central US where like it's really cold. And they've previously grown old clones of Achira and ornamental varieties. And they have to dig them up and like put them in a shed to protect them over winter. And they noted that my varieties didn't die, like the frosts and the freeze didn't kill them. And I didn't breed them for that, but I just have a really variable population because I did a recent hybridization to wild ancestors from domesticated clones that were a little bit weak under my conditions. And that's an example of the power of a grex. Like you can take that early, not very productive, not very optimized population. Like their tubers aren't as big as the old domesticated forms, but it's got all sorts of possibilities in there that you just have to put it in a different environment and see what it can do. And maybe 90% of them will die from some weird pest, or they'll hate that local soil, or sure. they'll freeze, but you only need a few of them to survive. And then you've got a miracle. You've got something new that was always there, but it just wasn't noticed before.
Yeah. Well, I'm also hedging my bets. I, let's say, gleaned some extra seeds from a botanic garden in Portugal and some varieties that I found growing in a garden from a neighbor back where we used to live. So, you know, we'll see if there's, first of all, good germination. Still crossing my fingers about that. They haven't popped up yet, but I will definitely keep you informed as I make some observations when we get some growing out here.
Did you do the hot water treatment? Like, don't hold back on the boiling water.
I still have a whole bunch. So if these ones don't sprout under that, I'll go and do that again. Yeah.
You have to do the hot water treatment. That's what I really love. It's another major advantage of Canna. The seeds are like bullets. Like they were used as buckshot in like the early days of rifles.
Kidding.
But they are so durable. So some crops like carrots or parsnips, you have to sow the seeds pretty much every year. They're difficult to store unless you've got refrigeration and drying, and particularly in humid climates like this. Canna seeds, you could like put them in a gourd and bury them in a cave and dig them up probably 200 years later and you'd still get germination. So
that's awesome.
that is a major plus as well, that they have that ability to recover from, you know, like an asteroid hitting us. You would probably still have some seed of these things to grow. They would probably come up spontaneously afterwards, just being buried in the soil.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and you said, so how long do I have to be in boiling water? Let's see if I did it.
Put them in a mug, boil the jug, let it get down to like 90 degrees, just wait like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you pour like a centimeter or two on top. So you want a shock. You want a spike in heat.
Cool.
And
that is
when
what
it works, you'll hear tinkling. You'll hear it tinkle like breaking glass.
Oh, really? Okay.
And soak them overnight and the seeds that are ready to germinate will swell up and they'll be ready to go.
As I do the exact same thing with the black locust seeds.
Yeah.
For those. Very cool. Well, okay. So look, there's obviously we can talk about this for the whole rest of the day, but can you tell us for our listeners some resources that they can find to learn more, as also where they can get your book? I heard that you're about to finish the audiobook version as well.
Yes. Yeah. It's just about to come out. Okay. So easiest place for anyone to access is my Substack blog, Zero Input Agriculture. So that's free to everyone. The podcast that I co-host with Joseph Lofthouse is called the Going to Seed Podcast, where we talk to amateur plant breeders and hopefully some animal breeders too, all around the world doing landrace and adaptation agriculture. The book is called Taming the Apocalypse, and it's just about to come out. I've finished the draft. I'm just going through the final steps of production. The first place I'm going to be releasing it is on Substack. So I've got a decent following there. I've got paid subscribers who get nothing for supporting me. So I will be releasing the audiobook version of Taming the Apocalypse as a series of podcast episodes for paid subscribers. I think the ebook version I may as well put up as a series of blog posts as well for people who prefer reading. So anyone can have it. And shortly after that, I will be packaging up both of those and finding other distribution channels. So if you really don't want to try Substack, there will be other options, though I'm hoping with this project I can avoid using Amazon and Audible. but they don't need any of my money. They don't need 70% of the few meager amounts of dollars that I'm going to make out of this. So I'm going to see if I can do it without them.
Yeah, that would be awesome if you could manage to get around that.
And if you are interested in my fiction, that is Our Vitreous Womb. It's a series of four novellas, so it's kind of broken into manageable chunks, and that's published under Haldane B. Doyle. So you can buy that through Amazon and Kobo. And maybe one of these days I'll do an audiobook of it. The Taming the Apocalypse audiobook was kind of like a trial run to see if I enjoy doing it, if I can get a bit better at it. And I think I can probably pull it off. So one day I'll go back and do that. But yeah, give it a go if you want to read some hard biological science fiction that is unlike anything else that's out there.
That's true. It definitely is. And one other thing I'll say is you've been generously active on our Discord server. So if anybody wants to connect with you and the whole rest of the community, there are some really good conversations going on regularly about people's gardening trials and their own little experiments at their homes, the different conditions and all of the challenges that they're going through. People are evaluating their land purchases, and there's such a good community of conversation happening there. And I love the contributions that you make, whether it's figuring out how fragile the infrastructure that we're dealing with is, or just what to plant in what soil conditions. There's always something good each week.
I love the community that you've built there. It's wonderful.
All right. Well, look, let's switch back to mostly chatting over there. It's been wonderful to catch up with you. I love this book. I'm going to be recommending it to a lot of people, and I'm going to pester you for the audiobook version as soon as it comes out, because that will keep me company while I'm out in the garden trying this stuff out in real life. So thank you again for making time, Shane. It's such a pleasure.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me back.
Thanks again to Shane. I've linked to his blog and where you can find his books all in the show notes at regenerativeskills.com. Now, before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account, @regen_skills, is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.